Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to introduce our guest this week, John Dorfman, who is the chairman of Dorfman Value Investments, LLC. As always, and I do see a couple of you beating me to the punch as per usual out there, please say hi. Let us know where you're viewing from over in that chat. We love seeing those international audience members. We're always happy to have everybody joining us here. Please feel free to post those questions and comments throughout the presentation here today. Keep in mind, we are going to go ahead and hold those until the end, so just bear with us as we cruise through the presentation. We will get to those questions. Without anything further from me, I'm going to go ahead and hand things over to John, and we can go ahead and jump into his presentation.
Thank you so much, Grandma. Thanks for having me here. Good to see you all. I called my little talk today, Observations of a Cigar Butt Investor. That's a reference to a remark that Warren Buffett once made. He said that investors who primarily look for cheap stocks are like people who pick a cigar butt off the sidewalk and say, oh, it looks like there's one or two more good puffs in this. I think I'll take it. Buffett said that he evolved from looking for a good company at a great price to later in his career looking for a great company at a good price. I, however, primarily am still like he was in the first half of his career. I put a great deal of emphasis on the price of the stock, which is something I think analysts underestimate. They pay so much attention to how things are going from an operating perspective, but in my opinion, don't pay enough attention to whether a stock is cheaply valued or not. Guru Focus and Graham had invited me to tell you how I got to this profession. So I actually got to it through journalism. I was a writer for many years, and I was working as a police reporter for a small paper in central New Jersey called the New Brunswick Home News. And the business writer died. And the editor-in-chief called me into his office, and I had applied for the business writer job because I was ready for a change from being the police reporter. And he said, do you know how this desk has been run in the past? Referring to the fact that the previous business writer had taken bribes on the order of a case of golf balls or having a sidewalk paved. And I said, yeah, I have a pretty good idea. And he said, fine, I don't want to talk about it. I just want to say it's not going to run that way in the future. So I had very few qualifications, but there were a few qualified candidates. So I got the job as a business writer with the little paper. And then from there, went to the business desk of the AP, freelanced, worked for Forbes for a while, which was a huge pleasure because Jim Michaels was the editor at the time, and he was a total genius. And that was the real, a real heyday of Forbes. And then I worked for the Wall Street Journal for 11 years. And while doing so, I interviewed a lot of investment managers, and I just liked the way they thought. Now, journalism, a lot of journalism is about how is today different from yesterday, but oftentimes it isn't. It isn't different at all. What's more interesting is how it's the same. And in money management, the decisions you make keep working either for you or against you until you change them. And you get to be judged quantitatively against your peers, which most years I find to be a good thing. So from the journal, I made the jump into money management by working for David Dreeman and then founded my own firm, Dorfman Value Investments, in late 1999. This guy that you see here is my father, and he was influential in sparking my interest in investing. He was actually a spy during World War II, which I'm very proud of. And there are some good stories that unfortunately are outside the realm of today's talk. But and he was an attorney with the New Deal and a labor relations lawyer. He was an inveterate stock market investor. He was 98% invested in stocks at the age of 98, making a shambles of the rule of thumb, which I don't believe in, which is that for every year old you are, you should have that percentage in bonds. So when you're 50 years old, you should be 50% in bonds. My father never believed that, nor do I. No one ever endowed a hospital with the proceeds of owning bonds, but many people have done it by owning equities. My dad also introduced me to the racetrack, and there are actually some similarities between investing and the daily racing form and the proceedings at the track. You can get a huge amount of information from that daily racing form. It looks a lot like reading the stock tables. And my dad explained to me that in a handicap race, which are all the high stakes races are handicap races, meaning that the fastest horses have to wear the heaviest saddles. Well, this is just like the stock market in that the most successful companies have the highest PEs. So it tends to equalize the chance of each horse winning the race, and tends to equalize the chance of doing well with an individual stock. Because if you're going to invest in, for example, Microsoft, you have to pay up for that stock because the investing world already knows that it's a good company. My dad also had an interesting explanation of how the Federal Reserve works, which is very relevant to where we are today with the Fed's tightening. He said that the economy is like a dog that jumps up on you, and the Fed is like a man with a rolled up newspaper. And if the economy gets too exuberant, it's jumping up on people too much, well then the man taps the dog lightly with the newspaper and it still keeps jumping up on people. Fed taps again, man taps again. The dog's still being too exuberant. Finally, the man gives the dog a good whack and it slinks into the corner and whines. Well, that's often what happens with the Fed. It's very hard to engineer a soft landing, which is the challenge the Fed faces now. But of course, we can all hope that this will be one of the times that they succeed in doing so, applying enough force to restrain inflation without killing economic growth. And that's the challenge the Fed has. It's not an easy one. One more remark my father made that early in my investing career, he looked at the stocks I had bought and he said, "Well, I think you've done a good job of picking your stocks. Too bad you didn't have enough money for it to make any difference." So that was his comment about my portfolio. When I became a professional investor, I worked for David Dreeman, who was a longtime columnist for Forbes and was my mentor in this business. Dreeman, one of the concepts that he paid a lot of attention to is the concept of uncertainty in the market, uncertainty in analysts' forecasts. He once made a bet with the members of his investment committee. It was a time when everyone was very gloomy about the market. And Dreeman said, "Well, let's make a bet about which way the market goes this week." And my colleague Jeff said, "Well, which side are you taking?" He said, "I'll take the side you don't take." And Jeff said, "Well, I believe it'll be down this week," which is what everyone believed at the time. "And do you still want the bet?" And David said, "Yeah, I'll take the bet." "Which side are you on?" "Well, I have to take up because you took down," Dreeman said. And sure enough, the market was up that week. Dreeman used to own a lot of tobacco stocks because he loved out of favor companies and industries. And when we asked him, "Why do you have so much in tobacco stocks?" he said, "I've never seen an industry so hated." He got a lot of pressure from Merrill Lynch, among others, to be less in tobacco. Finally, he yielded to the pressure from Merrill Lynch and reduced tobacco from 18% of the portfolio to 17% of the portfolio. He ended up making a lot of money in those tobacco stocks. He was, of course, a devotee of low-P investing. In fact, he was one of the popularizers of that investing philosophy in the 1980s, mainly through his book, Contrarian Investment Strategies, and also through his Forbes column. Now, why does low PE work, or should I say, why did it work so well for most of the 80 years up until the past decade? Because the past decade has not been kind to value investing, but I'm sticking with it because I believe it's philosophically sound and will revive. Anyway, why does low PE often work? Dreeman's explanation was it's a differential reaction to earnings surprise. if a stock has high expectations and then it has a disappointment, it tends to plunge. If it has high expectations, analysts are predicting very good earnings for the quarter or the year, and it does well, it doesn't move that much. But if a stock is out of favor and people have low expectations and the stock has a low PE, then a favorable earnings surprise has a big effect, and an unfavorable one doesn't have too much effect because the stock is already standing on the ground practically. It doesn't have very far to fall. So Dreamin felt that this differential reaction to earnings surprise was a major explanation for why low PE investing tends to work. And the corollary to that is that earnings surprises are just so common. He did an extensive study of analysts' estimates covering, about 20 years. He had a lot of data. And he found that close to half the time, analysts' forecasts 1 year ahead are more than 10% off, and frequently far more. So earnings surprises come along all the time, and they're often the catalyst for out-of-favor stocks doing better or popular stocks not doing as well as one might think. I've made my own small contribution to the literature of analyst fallibility. For 23 years, I've been tracking how the four stocks that analysts most love at the beginning of the year do in the 12-month time frame, and the four stocks that they most despise. And this is just done by buy and sell ratings. The most adored stocks always have 20 to 30, sometimes 35 or so buy ratings and no holds, no sells. And the most despised stocks have at least 2/3 of the ratings usually are sells. And occasionally you get unanimity on the sell side. But as many of you know, Wall Street doesn't like to apply a sell rating to a stock because then the company won't talk to the analyst anymore. So they often resort to the euphemism of a hold. But the stocks that are really despised have more than half sell ratings. And how did they do? Well, on average, the stocks that analysts adored the most have been up only 7.8% for the year. The stocks that they just hated have been up an average of 8.1%. So the average is actually a little better for the despised stocks, not every year, but on average over the 23 years that I've been doing this. Meanwhile, both of them have grossly underperformed the S&P, which for these years that I looked at has been up an average of 12.8%. So just pitting the adored against the despised and ignoring the S&P for a moment, the analysts have 12 wins and 10 losses. That is 10 times the despised stocks have outperformed. And there was 1 year where they tied. If you pit the analysts against the S&P, only 7 times out of 23 have the adored stocks beaten the S&P. So if your son or daughter wants to marry a stock analyst, you don't necessarily need to oppose the marriage, but don't take your son-in-law's or daughter-in-law's word for which stocks you should buy, because like most experts, the analysts are fallible. Predicting the future is very hard for human beings. Moving to my firm and the stocks that I pick for our clients, how do we get our ideas? These are the main ways. I'd say about 90% of our ideas come from one of these sources. First, and one of my favorites, is buying on bad news. If you know a company well and it runs into some bad news that's real but temporary, that's a great time to invest in the stock. And one example of this I like to cite because it's a pleasant memory. We had a very small position in Cameco, a uranium miner mined about, as I recall, about 10% of the world's uranium. And much of it was from one mine, which was adjacent to a river. Well, the river flooded and all activity had to cease at the mine. And when that happened, we loaded up on the stock because we thought, this is the very kind of event we want. It's bad news that's real, but almost certainly temporary. So we thought this mine is going to be working again. We don't know exactly how soon, but you know, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, it should be back online. It did take quite a while to get the mine pumped out and working in, but meantime, Cameco had enough enough uranium in inventory to fill demand, and then they got working again, and that stock doubled for us. I should end the story there because that's such a pleasant way to end it, but actually it doubled again after we sold it, but that's neither here nor there. We also get a lot of ideas from screens, and I'll describe one of those screens on one of the next slides. But we have several. We have what I call the robot screen, which just looks for the very lowest PEs. We have what I call the bunny screen, named after the Energizer bunny, that keeps going long after you would have expected it to poop out. And so the bunny screen is stocks that historically have had 25% or better earnings growth and yet are selling for 12 times earnings or less. Well, how can that even happen? It can just happen if people think that that company has hit a wall or is about to hit a wall. But because people are poor predictors of the future, my reasoning was that oftentimes the companies would continue to enjoy more success than the market expects. So that's one that we use. And then we have a very conventional screen that I call Hope Faithful that just looks for a combination of earnings growth, high return on equity, modest price to book, modest price sales, and so on. And we have about three dozen screens that I use, but those three the most often. Another source of ideas is other money managers. And this can either be through just social conversations, or it can just be by looking at 13F filings. So when there are people I respect, for example, Randall Ely, manager in Washington, D.C., Scott Black in Boston, Ken Huebner in Boston, David Katz in New York, I'm always interested to see what they own, and I'll look at it to see if it meets the criteria for us and our clients. Then a little less often, we use Wall Street Research. Based on the study that I just described to you, you can see why we don't take Wall Street recommendations as gospel, but the analysts are fantastic at giving you a lot of facts from which you can draw your own conclusions. And occasionally there are analysts who, you know, if they have a buy recommendation, that's something we want to take a good hard look at. Another source of ideas is I write a syndicated column. It appears on Guru Focus. It appears in Forbes.com and in a few newspapers, the Virginia Pilot, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Omaha World Herald. People write me and say, you know, you're crazy to like this or you're crazy to dislike that. That dialogue is very useful in forming ideas. And lastly, whenever we talk to a company, we always ask them, which competitors do you most respect? Which competitors do you fear? Which competitors do you think really don't know what they're doing and are likely to trip up? So that's another good source of ideas. And once we have a candidate, then we have to analyze whether to put it in the portfolio. And of course, the portfolio is a amalgam that should have a certain balance. We are perfectly happy to have very different sector weights than the S&P 500. If technology stocks are about 27% of the S&P as they currently are, you know, we might have only half as much, or we might have even more. Energy stocks are only about 4% of the S&P now, but many of our portfolios are or soon will be double that or a little more. So we don't want to mimic the index by any means, but we want to take into account the sector balance. And so typically we hold about 25 stocks for people. Usually most of those are in the U.S. with this little sprinkling in Europe, Australia, and Asia. And so now we have a candidate. Are we going to make room for it in the portfolio? First thing I look at, being a cigar butt investor, as I said at the outset, is the valuations. The price-earnings ratio, I'd like to see it 15 or less. Why 15? Because that's the historical norm for the average stock in the market. Price to book, I like to see 2 or less. If it's less than 1, that's more attractive to me. If I think there's a good reason why the stock is out of favor, it might return to favor. Price to sales, again, I usually look for less than 2 and preferably less than 1. Then we look at the balance sheet. This is available to every single investor on the planet, but I feel many people don't pay enough attention to it. Investors these days are often fixated on growth and look at earnings growth and revenue growth, but that's all they look at. They don't pay attention to the balance sheet. And the balance sheet can really tell you a lot about a company. So virtually every stock we buy has debt less than equity, and many of them have debt less than 50% of equity. If it has no debt whatever, to me, that's a plus. To some people, that might mean they're not taking advantage of certain opportunities, but I feel that low debt companies have tremendous flexibility in, they can make acquisitions, they can buy troubled competitors when the industry goes through a slump, they can survive a slump without having to resort to drastic measures such as selling off a promising division. So it's been, I'd say the past 5 years, it's probably been a disadvantage to prefer low debt companies as I do. But I think in the next 5 years, it will, as it traditionally is, be an advantage. So to us, balance sheet's very important. Then we look at insider trades. Now, all kinds of reasons someone might sell their own company's stock. You know, a kid may be going to college. They may be going through a divorce. They may be buying a home. But there's only one reason to buy, and that's if you believe in your own company's prospects for capital appreciation. So buying has more predictive value than selling. But both should be paid attention to. We have owned, I think, 3 times over the years, Sanderson Farms, the chicken producer. And we noticed, this was back a good decade ago, we noticed that 3 insiders, all of whom, or 2 of whom were named Sanderson, had sold shares. So we asked ourselves, gosh, what could be the reason? And we sort of poked around a little and noticed there was some avian flu was a concern on the horizon. So I wish I could say we sold outright, but that wouldn't be true. But we did reduce our position. And then sure enough, the avian flu worsened and the stock declined. So even though buys are more predictive, sells are worth paying attention to as well. Finally, we do look for a catalyst. We don't necessarily insist that every purchase must have one, but we'd like to have a reason why we think the stock should do better than the consensus on Wall Street. Thanks. And after we look at those 4 factors, then the 5th step is we get together. My colleagues and I get together, talk it over, and then make a final decision about what goes in the portfolio. I told you I would talk a little bit about one of the screens we use, which is the robot portfolio. This is quite simply the 10 cheapest stocks in the market measured by price earnings ratio, with the provisos that this company must be at least 500 million, which gives a tiny bit of a margin of safety and resiliency. It must not have too much debt, which means debt has to be less than equity. And of course, earnings have to be positive so that the PE ratio can be calculated. With those provisos, it's just simply the 10 cheapest stocks. And frankly, this model sometimes spits out names that I felt I wouldn't go near, I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. Other names we have certainly added to the portfolio. And over the years, the the robot portfolio, the hyper cheap stocks, have returned 1,203%, while the S&P has returned 578%. And that's in the last 23 years, which is how long I've been writing the syndicated column that I mentioned before. So the robot was created to dramatize that even a naive stock picking model that picks very out of favor stocks can perform well. So it has performed well over that full time span, but in candor, I should also mention it has underperformed lately. The last few years have been rough on value investors. As many of you know, the robot has underperformed the S&P in each of the past 4 years, but often has gotten healthy gains, but not as good as the index in the last 4 years. Now, all of you being investing mavens and stock jockeys and the like, let's talk about a few specific names and the process by which we got to them. Walt Disney is an example of a bad news buy. The bad news on which I bought it in November 2018 concerned ABC and ESPN networks. At the time, people were very concerned that they were losing advertising dollars to the internet and viewership wasn't growing. And so Disney got out of favor for a while and we were able to get it at a good price. Probably an even better moment to buy it would have been around March of 2019 in the big bear market accompanying the worldwide coronavirus pandemic. We already owned it, but added on the decline that the stock suffered in the pandemic. Of course, the theme parks had to close down. The movie theaters were and often still are empty. And so this bad news depresses Disney shares. And we've made some money, as you see on the slide. We've gone from 116 to 154. And the reason we've made some money is Disney launched its streaming service, Disney Plus, and it's done quite well. So the company has held up better than expected. But I'm looking forward to when the theme parks fully reopen and the movie theaters begin to be more packed again. I think there's a lot of room for further gains in Disney. Most of our clients own MarineMax, and that's not a buying on bad news purchase. It's more buying something that's neglected or not noticed by people, because I think what stops most people from being interested in a boat retailer, MarineMax is the largest U.S. boat retailer, boats and yachts. I think what stops most people from wanting to invest there is they fear that this company is vulnerable to recession. And indeed, in the Great Recession, the stock fell all the way from 29 to 8. So it's a reasonable fear. But what's been going on in the last couple of years, people who have a lot of assets have been buying boats and yachts. The company has been doing very well with its sales. And boating and yachting are relatively a refuge from the pandemic. That's not like, you know, going to Gillette Stadium to watch a Patriots game. You're not exposed to huge crowds. You're out in the fresh air. The inequality in incomes that increasingly has affected our country ever since the 1970s, the inequality has been growing. And you may think that's bad for the country. I think it's bad for the country, but it's good if you're a boat retailer or a yacht retailer. So we think MarineMax is that people exaggerate the fear perhaps and underestimate the good news that's going on. Those first two that I mentioned have MarineMax is about where it was when we bought it, and Disney is up, but I think has not been up dramatically. Pioneer Resources has been a dramatic success story for us. We bought it in June of 2020. That was about the sixth year of a six-year bear market in energy, just horrible shakeout in energy. But what people didn't pay enough attention to was that there was a capitulation in 2019 and 2020 where energy companies greatly reduced the number of rigs. And you can follow that by looking up the Baker Hughes rig count online. All the details are available. You don't need to subscribe to an expensive monitoring service to know what the U.S. rig count is. So after 6 years of energy stocks declining, we thought that they were near a bottom. And the reason I picked Pioneer Resources was very simple. If I go into a really troubled industry, I want to buy the company with the best balance sheet or one of the best balance sheets in the industry. And Pioneer Resources had a very strong balance sheet. Today, debt is only 31% of equity, which for an energy company is quite good. And so far, that's done very well for us. Fourth and last stock I'd like to talk about is Berkshire Hathaway. Of course, as most of you know, this is the lair of Warren Buffett, who most people consider the preeminent investor of our times. His annual reports, if you haven't read them, you would enjoy reading them. They're always very intelligent, nuanced, full of humor and insight. Berkshire Hathaway is a conglomerate. It's multi-industries. They own close to 100 companies outright, and they have stakes in partial stakes in close to 100 other companies, including very well-known ones like Coca-Cola. That's one reason why I think Berkshire is undervalued. Two reasons it's undervalued. First, it's a conglomerate, and conglomerates are out of favor. Secondly, they don't get full credit statistically for their holdings in other companies because it's not consolidated into their earnings. They own less than 20% of the company. Now, the reason why people are afraid to invest in Berkshire Hathaway is that Warren is 91, his sidekick Charlie Munger is 98. So people are worried that when they pass away, the tremendous success that Berkshire's had the last 30 years will vanish. But I think they've done a good job of with their succession process. And I think Greg Abel, the designated successor, is going to be a good man. And when I say, as you see on the slide, I said the company is a tangerine, that's an expression for a conglomerate that could easily be disaggregated and its divisions sold separately. And I think the price they would get if they did go through a disaggregation would be far in excess of the current market price. Guru Focus is also interested in our thoughts. By our, I mean the guest speakers in this series, our thoughts on the market. Take these with several grains of salt in my case and probably in anyone's case. My market prediction plus $2.50 will get you a great cup of coffee. But for what it's worth, I have a back of the envelope market model, which you see here. I think 40% of the weight goes to valuation. Is the market cheap or expensive? Right now, it's on the expensive side, but doesn't look as expensive as it did a year and a half ago because earnings have come up so rapidly. And to some extent, book value and revenue have risen with them. So the valuation statistics don't look terrible, but they're on the whole, it is an expensive market. Interest rates are very important. I give them about a 30% weight. They are, of course, rising, and the market has been very jittery lately because the Fed is making noises about 4 interest rate hikes next year, perhaps 5. The fact that they're going to rise is a negative. However, don't forget that they're rising from an incredibly low point, so interest rates are still low, which is a favorable factor. The economy, I think, will boom again when we have the third reopening following the latest wave of COVID. This is an iffy thing because who knows if there'll be a fourth wave and what it will be like. But I think there's a lot of pent-up demand and a lot of buying power on the sidelines. And then I would give about a 10% weight to technical indicators in the market. There's been a lot of talk about how a few favored stocks have a big weight in the indexes, and that's quite true. But it's if you study market history, it's actually always been true. So it's not as big of a bearish factor as you might think. I personally don't put too much weight on the Ukraine situation or on politics, because I think history shows that international events and politics definitely influence the market, but not as strongly as the economy and interest rates do. So my guess, to use the technical term, my guess is that the market will be up single digits, perhaps about 7% this year. And then let's close with a couple more observations about politics and stocks. For those of you who are very strongly Republican or very strongly Democratic, there's considerable evidence that the market can do well even if your opponents win. Here are the best and worst performers of the last 15 presidents in terms of the compound return in the market. I see I have a typo here. It says that Bill Clinton's is 27.5, but that should be 17.5. Barack Obama was second at 16. So the top two are Democrats, but then we have Donald Trump, Gerald Ford, and Dwight Eisenhower, all Republicans. And then Joe Biden so far, 14.9. So six best performances under presidents, three are for Republicans, three for Democrats. The worst performers are shown at the bottom, and they are all Republicans. However, there is an offset to that. Here's some statistics from Ned Davis Research, my favorite research firm. Under Democratic presidents, the market has averaged 7.9, and under Republicans, 3.6. But inflation is better controlled under the Republicans. So if you want to look at real returns, they're not too far from equal. So you may, and I encourage you to have strong political views, but don't let it color your market view excessively, because the market is not moved primarily by politics. So that concludes my prepared remarks. And now we come to the interesting part, which is your questions and observations.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for walking us through all of that, John. Definitely some interesting points in there. I'm sure some questions will pour in on them here as we get the ball rolling. First up front, though, from Jason, who tends to beat everybody in and get his questions in before we even start the stream. He is curious, asking, obviously, we hit a little bit on Buffett there. We had his nice smile up there on the screen for us. He's questioning here your view on concentration, so more on the Buffett side of things, versus diversification, so a little bit more on the Walter Schloss side of things. Any thoughts there between the two? Obviously, you maintain about 25-ish positions there, so relatively concentrated, but any consideration of diversification, I guess, there?
I think it only takes about 40 stocks to get performances asymptotic to a market index. So if you're investing in primarily big cap US stocks, I think it only takes about 40 of them so that your returns will pretty strongly resemble the S&P. Warren Buffett says that he believes diversification is overrated. You know, put all your eggs in one basket and watch that basket, he once said. And yet, as I said, Berkshire Hathaway has full or partial stakes in close to 200 companies. So in practice, he does practice diversification. I think it's a good thing. And trying to get performance that's different from the market, and I hope most years better, that's why I have fewer than 40 stocks, usually around 25, because that gives me a chance to get away from the market. And you mentioned Walter Schloss. I don't know how diversified Walter historically was, although I certainly have been interested in some of his observations. Can anyone tell me how diversified he is or was?
All right. Well, we will, I guess, hold that thought then for the time being to see if we can get a little bit of that info rolling in through the chat. Jason did have a follow-up question here for you, though, and we hit a little bit on this as well here at the end of things. He was asking for your thoughts with these inflation-based rate hikes coming. Is that going to bring some volatility into the market that could, I guess, throw things sideways for us?
Oh, sure, Jason. Of course, it will. Every time the Fed tightens, it will bring volatility. I used to think that if an event was heavily forecast, that it wouldn't move the market much. How wrong I was to think that, because even when you know that bad news or good news is coming, when it actually comes, there's always still a jolt in either direction. So if, let's just say, the Fed tightens four times in this calendar year, each time I expect the stocks will suffer some decline. So yeah, I think it'll be a more volatile year than the last 3 to 5 years. My guess is it will net be up. The Fed has, which used to guard its secrets very heavily, has become better at giving investors a heads up in advance. And I think that will help cushion the impact a little bit. But yes, the inflation numbers as they roll in, if they continue to be bad, and the interest rate increases, will certainly hurt a lot of industries. One industry that might actually benefit from interest rate increases is the banking industry. There's an old joke about, what does a banker do? Borrows at 2%, sells the loans at 3%, and hits the golf course by 4%. Well, that joke was from the 1950s, but if you borrow at 2% and lend at 3%, your profit is a lot less than if you borrow at 4% and lend at 8%. So rising interest rates are generally good for banks. So that's one industry that might be helped. And the reason interest rates are going up is because we have some inflation, and material stocks might do well. Most years I don't own any gold, but I think gold traditionally holds its real purchasing power pretty well, which means that the nominal price of gold tends to go up during inflation. So, you know, we have a little gold, we have a little steel. We're trying to have the portfolios positioned so they won't be hurt too much by inflation and rising rates.
Understood. And continuing down our list, we just had a bunch of questions roll in here, so we got plenty of lined up now. Praveen, we did hit on this a little bit. You mentioned a little bit of investment in Europe, a little bit of Asia. He was just hoping you could expand that a little bit more. Any thoughts there, kind of moving out into the international sphere of investment?
Well, first of all, hello, Praveen. Thank you for the comments you've left on my articles on Guru Focus. I appreciate them. We usually are interested in China, but not so much at this moment. President Xi's actions have been more autocratic than we'd like to see, and his attitudes towards capitalism have been less pro-capitalist and more pro-communist in the throwback sense than we want to see. So we've reduced our presence in China, and we're looking for the right time to go back in, but I'm chicken to do so at this moment. So what we currently have, we have in the 25 stock portfolio, there's one stock from Switzerland, which is Logitech. There's one stock from Germany, which is Volkswagen. There's one stock from France, which is Total Energies. And then we have one Australian stock, which is Sonic Healthcare, a pathology lab that's number 3 in the U.S., but number 1 in a lot of other countries. And we have Sony in Japan. So we've tried to diversify our international exposure a little bit. And if the U.S. should suffer a bear market, we hope that will buffer the impact a little bit. Although, you know, it's always possible the U.S. catches a cold and Asia catches the flu, but we think that it's a good time to not be too all-American with our holdings.
Understood. And it looks like Siddharth is coming in asking, do you manage money for high net worth individuals only, or can anybody approach you?
At this moment, anyone can approach. Traditionally, our minimum is $250,000, but during the pandemic, we accept accounts of any size. So we'd be happy to have you or your friend, Siddharth.
For sure. And then looking down to our next question, Steve, let me process this one real quick. It's a little bit long. He's asking, what do you think of the quickly flattening yield curve at around 44 points currently and its good predictive value of recessions 8 to 12 months later?
My understanding is that when the yield curve inverts, it doesn't always predict a recession, but it certainly has a strong statistical correlation with recession. So it is something we should all keep our eyes on. And it has been flattening some. I made some remarks about the banks earlier. For the sake of the banks, you would like to see the yield curve a little steeper because they typically borrow relatively short term and lend relatively long term. Mortgage rates and business loans are usually longer term. And the deposits tend to be short term. So yes, it's something to keep an eye on. And if you think a recession is knocking on the door, you should be more in healthcare, more in cash, more in gold, perhaps more in tobacco or consumer staples that are very stable. From the time the Fed first begins to tighten to the time a recession starts, traditionally has been a long time, by which I mean about 24 months. So I don't think a recession is knocking on the door right now, but if and when you think so, those are some defensive steps you might want to take.
Definitely. And I'll go ahead and expand that question to one that I've seen come up in a couple of our last presentations here, asking, are you maintaining, I guess, higher levels of cash or cash positions that you hadn't previously maintained, not necessarily planning for something to happen, but just with current circumstances, is that a consideration for you?
We're not raising much cash now. My wife manages some portfolios. It's Catherine Davidge. She manages some portfolios at our firm, and she's raised a little bit of cash. And I haven't raised any, so I'm at 1.5% cash. In 22 years of running this firm, I've raised cash 3 times, and only once has it been accretive for our clients. So the one time was in the Great Recession of, mostly 2008, started in 2007, didn't end until 2009. And we had about 15% cash then, which I thought was radically high. But of course, now we wish it had been even higher. We also have to be mindful always that people aren't paying us to manage cash. We charge a good fee, and you can have your cash managed at your local bank for free, or a money market fund for free. There are times when one should raise cash. What I don't think one should ever do, even in 2008, is flee the market entirely and be all in cash. Every time I've had a client do that, they've regretted it later. I mean, even in 2008, the market got back before too long. Now you can say, well, okay, in 1929, it didn't get back for a decade or more, depending on how you count. But I don't think it's intelligent to plan your investment strategy on the assumption we're going to have another Great Depression in the style of the 1930s. So I believe in having only modest amounts of cash at most times. And if you do get bearish and raise cash, that's fine. But I would not recommend ever being less than 50% in stocks personally.
Understood. And it looks like we have Eric chiming in here. He says he never misses your columns. He notices you often reference canonical valuation health metrics, so PE, PB, debt to equity, etc. Do you perform more adjustment outside of your columns? For example, EBIT or EBITDA, enterprise value, market cap? And then if so, how do you determine when those adjustments are appropriate?
We use them mainly as cross checks. Enterprise value to EBITDA or cash flow measures, price to cash flow. I find them quite useful as cross checks, but perhaps because I'm a simple minded guy, my three favorite measures are the three that I often cite in the column, which are price to book, price to sales, and price to earnings. One thing about cash flow measures is different analysts measure it differently. And so it's bad enough just to know what the PE of a stock is because different databases will differ on that. But that's even more true with cash flow metrics. Plus, I'm kind of a partisan of GAAP accounting. I think there's a good reason why you might not want to add back depreciation and amortization, for example, to earnings, because as Warren Buffett said when he was discussing the Burlington Santa Fe Railroad, he said, we find that to maintain the railroad in good shape, you have to spend more than what you might statistically think is the maintenance capital expenditures. So I'm a big fan of GAAP and GAAP earnings, and but I do use some of those other measures you mentioned as just as a cross check.
All right. And looks like Raphael chimed in on some of those first points, saying in Reagan's time, office market was up an annual rate of 16.9%, just to toss a number out there. Looking down our list, though, Abel chimed in. He's asking if you would be able to give us a brief outline of the screener you use for your published balance sheet powerhouse list. Do the stocks on that list always enter your current portfolio?
Oh, by no means, because for those who aren't familiar with this one, once a year I publish a list that I call the balance sheet powerhouses, and these are companies that have 300 million or more in cash or in current assets, which is often mostly cash, and have debt less than 10% of stockholders' equity. They also, as of the latest iteration, have to be at least 5 billion in market cap. So these are companies that have very solid balance sheets, and I'm trying to counteract what I think is the bias of most investors to focus myopically on earnings and ignore the balance sheet. So I want to honor these companies that have accumulated wealth and done a great job of doing so. But would I buy their stocks? Often not, because their excellence is often already recognized in the marketplace. And there's usually about somewhere like three dozen stocks that make the balance sheet powerhouse list. And each year I recommend one, two, three, or four of them as stocks that I would suggest buying.
Understood. And it looks like we have a follow-up here from Steve on that earlier question, talking about the flattening yield curve, asking if it is indeed flattening, about to invert, would you say that the inflation trade is then too crowded at this point in time?
That's a great question. Simple answer is, I don't know whether that trade is too crowded, but I think it's not. And the reason is that when I look at companies that seem to me to be potentially beneficiaries of inflation, companies usually in the material sector, like steel companies, chemical companies, and gold companies or gold ETFs, such as the Spider ETF, GLD, which we own, most of those companies don't seem to me to have excessive valuation, so I don't think the investor enthusiasm has yet resulted in capital swarming into them. Is the other interesting thing about the question that Steve, I think, asked was, it looks to him like the yield curve is about to invert. I won't believe that until we get much closer to it. I think it might actually widen out again at the long end, but we'll see.
Definitely. It looks like Raphael's coming in, poking for your thoughts on some of the mega cap stocks out there. So we tossed out Apple, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. I guess any general thoughts on these, where we might be heading with them?
Well, I want to preserve some marital harmony here. I mentioned that my wife, Catherine Davidge, manages some portfolios at our company, and she owns Microsoft. She owns Amazon, which I don't own either of them because the PE price book and price sales are too rich for my blood. I do, however, own Google and Apple. I think Google is, make a good case, it's the most innovative company in the United States. And the PE is in the 20s. It's not in the 40s or 50s. So I think it's justified by the company's remarkable historic growth. And it's a leader in many fields. It's a leader in search engines. It's probably a leader in self-driving cars, although it's hard to evaluate the pipeline there. But its Waymo division is, according to most accounts I see, leading or close to leading in that realm. Of course, they have YouTube, which is a advertising cash cow. And they have the DeepMind division, which, for full disclosure, my daughter works for in London. But I think it's worth the PE, which is a little higher than I normally would pay. Much the same about Apple. You know, the fortress balance sheet and the great loyalty of its users, I think, are big assets for Apple. So of the stocks, I call the Sacred Seven. Some people call them Fang, Fang Plus, Fan Mag. Of those, Google and Apple are my favorites.
All righty then. And it looks like Praveen's coming in here with one of our favorite questions that we've come to love, asking, what are some of the biggest lessons you have learned from the biggest mistakes throughout your career?
That's always a good question to ask. Things can always go further than you think. A stock that's very cheap can get cheaper. A recession that has lasted a long time can last longer. And conversely, a boom can last longer. And I think as a value investor, I tend to get out of things a little too early when they appreciate. So I've over the years tried to learn to be a slower seller. The example I gave near the start of this conversation about the uranium miner Cameco is an example of that. We got out of Cameco with a double, but had we stayed in, we could have had a quadruple. So I try to be slower in selling than I used to be. And, I used to sell, at the beginning of my career, I used to sell stocks if they hit the market multiple, but now I don't. I think that Sir John Templeton, who was a great, great investor, said that his sell rule was sell when you find something else that's twice as good a value. He said, the reason I say twice as good is because there's so much uncertainty connected with these decisions. So I think that that's one mistake I've learned from. And then I don't know if I learned from it or learned enough from it, but I alluded to the fact that in 22 years, I've raised cash three times and twice had proved to be not helpful. One of those was when we had the first Gulf War, and I thought Saddam Hussein was going to gas our troops. And I thought the market would take that very badly. Well, he didn't. And the market was pretty much flat during that conflict. So I don't know if I fully assimilated lessons from that, but as I said, I think one potential lesson there is that companies' profitability, companies' competitive edge, interest rates, and profits matter more than politics, including international affairs.
Definitely. Well, some great words of wisdom there, and it looks like that is going to round out our questions here, John. So thank you so much for joining us today, giving us that wonderful presentation, and taking the time to answer all these questions for our audience. I know they really do appreciate you coming out here.
Well, thanks for having me. It was nice to see you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.